We live in some of the toughest economic times, and it's natural for brands and consumers to reduce spend. In this episode, Refulwe Maluleke, the Chief Strategy Officer of TBWA in South Africa and the MD of Yellowwood, joins us to share thoughts on how brands can still show up in difficult times.
And the first step is actually the simplest, right? Show up. people remember and reward brands who are there in good times and in bad. And the temptation is so strong to withdraw completely when times are tough.
We also discuss why it's so important to stick to your brand essence and not follow every trend. Please share this episode and subscribe to The Lead Creative wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome to The Lead Creative Podcast, where we talk to creative industry leaders, influencers, and brands. We discuss the strategies that influence brand thinking and shape industries. Thought leaders and heads of agencies let us in on some of their thinking and insights. I'm your host, Mongezi Simthati. Enjoy the show, and please share and subscribe. Refulwe, thank you so much for making the time to join us on The Lead Creative. It's great to have you on.
Thank you so much, Mongezi. What a pleasure to be here talking to you.
Awesome. Refulwe, just to start, growing up, was the creative industry the most obvious place that you'd end up, or how did it happen? How did you end up here?
Most certainly not. Not at all. It's funny, I didn't even actually want to study business science. I actually wanted to do journalism and linguistics. That's really what I wanted. I wanted to go to Rhodes and just read English books. But my father felt absolutely not. He said, your options are business science at UCT and business science at UCT and business science at UCT.
So three options.
So that's what I did. Yeah, those are my three options, right? So that's what I ended up doing. And while I was at UCT, I came across marketing. It's one of the courses you do in business science. And I guess I was really fortuitous that my sister's husband was in marketing for SAB. And so I guess the combination of those two things of starting to really understand what marketing is. And, it is about human psychology. It is about behavior. It is about how do you use this powerful thing called brand, to get people to behave the way you want them to. And the power that has to unlock good in the world for me just felt extraordinary. It absolutely kind of attracted me to it. And from there, so I joined Unilever and got to work on some really amazing, inspiring brands like Rama and Flora, brands that are really committed to kind of doing good in the world. Then moved to SAB and worked on Hansa Pilsner, which was incredible because at the time it was a brand that wanted to do more. It was the triumph of like Vuyo is a big dreamer, yeah, and supporting up and coming entrepreneurs, which is just like motivating, exciting stuff. And also it's fun. It's a lot of fun to sell beer. And then decided that strategy is my happy place, Yellowwood felt like a natural transition to where I could just focus on the strategy behind brand and marketing, without the execution, which while it is fun, it isn't the thing that brings me joy.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how I landed up where I am.
Now, having been on both the brand and agency side of the desk or table, how can brands approach being present and resonating with customers?
That's a very big question, Mongezi. The thing I always say is, obviously, like anything else, firstly, understand who you want to talk to, right? Know who your consumer is and don't just know them superficially in terms of whatever, their age and gender and, where they live, but really know them intimately, the things that matter to them, the things that they worry about, what their ambitions are. Really get to know them. And then make sure that you are adding value to their lives in some way, shape or form, because those are the brands that inevitably end up resonating the best with consumers, not just in terms of how they feel about you, but in the fact that they choose you again and again. Is that the value you add to their lives, both emotionally and functionally, is crystal clear. Yeah. And I think sometimes brand underestimate that making it crystal clear is also the journey of time, right? You need to communicate that for a long time. But yeah, I mean, just as I said, know your consumer and then make sure that you are adding value to them both emotionally and functionally.
So with all the data that we have, with everything that we have at our disposal, to your point about knowing your customer and knowing people not at a superficial level, we time and time again realize that brands don't know people, right? Brands and the people on this side of the fence, the agency side of the fence, who help these brands also equally don't know the people. And this is why these things happen. And I want to almost touch on what you've just mentioned now, that it's a time thing, that, you know, you need to continue communicating it and living it time and time again as a brand. But by today's standards, a brand does something and they are almost on the brink of either not being a brand that resonates, being a brand that kind of loses favor with people, Budweiser being an example right now. And I don't know if they come back from obscurity after what happened. So how do you, one, invest the time in communicating in a time when within a split second you can be forgotten and be the enemy?
So I guess there's sort of two parts to that question, right? The one is around, you know, doing something that doesn't work, and then how do you come back from that and not be seen as the enemy? And the other part is that kind of, you know, striving for consistency without kind of becoming irrelevant, I guess, in some way, shape, or form, or being quiet, I guess. And the latter is an easier one to answer. You know, I like to use brands that are doing particularly well. And the last Kantar Global Brands Research spoke to Apple being the number one brand globally, right? And think about, Apple has been communicating Think Different since 1986. Okay. That's longer than most people listening to this podcast have been alive. Yeah. You know what I mean? You know, for them to stay true to that and simply find ways to make it culturally relevant, right? So in 1986, when they launched it, you know, there was that white woman with a big, I don't even know what it is, like a massive hammer, and she's running down the aisle or whatever it is. It felt relevant. It moved on to that kind of Albert Einstein and people who, you know, were crazy enough to change the world. And today, the latest work that they just won an award for at Cannes is actually about inclusivity in a huge way. So it's a whole lot of ad called The Greatest. Please watch it. It's really good. It's communication that focuses on how they are innovating their products to create these tools for doers, tools for people who think differently, or creative, what do they call them? Tools for creative minds. How they are creating them for everybody who thinks differently, no matter how you are abled, right? And I think that that's powerful, that they have stayed true to that for 30 years or whatever it is, close on that. And simply finding a way to make it more culturally relevant as they progress. And you'll see they don't throw out 30 ads in a year, or 10 ads in a year, or 5 ads in a year, right? They really limit themselves, quite intentionally so, to how it is that they communicate it, because they know people don't have the headspace for it. So you've got to, for me, I think less is definitely more. And it gives people a chance to really absorb your message and connect with it, and for your communication to be memorable, and for you to be willing to invest more in it in terms of how much you spend producing it to make it beautiful and memorable and iconic and disruptive, and also how much you flight it, if you only have to flight one ad a year versus 7 or 8 ads a year. Then your other question around, you know, how do you come back when you make a faux pas? It's always an interesting one, because we talk about it a lot. You know, my perspective is that as long as your faux pas is completely anchored in who you are as a brand, that is still true to you, and you weren't trying to do something cool and hip and trendy that doesn't feel true to you. I think people have a lot of energy for brands that try things and make mistakes. You know, the example I actually was using with my team the other day is that everybody talks about how amazing Chicken Licken ads are. Shout out to Joe Public, great work. But I think for every one piece of like Big John, right? Let's use that example. They are like three or four executions when I'm like, what was that about? Guys, what is happening? Yeah. And it's not that they're not aligned. They're just not great pieces of work. And I think that's it. You've got to, as long as, you know, you are going to make mistakes, and that's fine. Consumers will forgive you as long as what you are doing is still true to who you are, and still anchored in the promise that you make to them. I think people forgive.
I definitely want to come back to this. But I just want to almost jump to this sort of advertising space a little bit more, because right now, you know, we are faced with the consumers faced with the highest levels of inflation that we've kind of ever experienced. And I think some reports are saying it's the highest it's been in 40 years or something along those lines, depending on who you listen to. And of course, this means the consumer is squeezed on the one side, and because the consumer is squeezed, they aren't shopping. And also the brand is also kind of squeezed a little bit, which means they have less budget for the advertising, the good work, the CSI, the CSR. In these kinds of times, how do brands still show up for the customer? How do they still remain relevant when they themselves have similar difficulties financially as the customer does?
It's a really good question, and one that my clients, you know, we've been discussing a lot with our clients. And the first step is actually the simplest, right? Show up.
Yeah.
You know, people remember and reward brands who are there in good times and in bad. And the temptation is so strong to withdraw completely when times are tough. And there's so much research to show you what a mistake that is, both in terms of when the times are tough, but also as we come out of the recession. There are brands that still continued to show up in that time, get a disproportionate share of the market when people are in good times again. So I think it is important to show up. And I think to answer your question about what do, you know, how do you show up? I think it's about trying to focus on what is going to be needed by your consumers. So from a functional lens, I think it's important that you demonstrate value. And by that, I don't mean like price promotions and deep discounting and giving away a whole lot of free stuff. I mean, help people understand how your product adds value, right? To their lives, and how it's, you know, an example I've used before is First Foreman Insurance, right? So they don't take on OUTsurance head to head and be like, yes, we are whatever, 300 Rand premium or 400 Rand premium, because they will always be more expensive. What they talk about is everything that you get for your premium. So the guardian angel and the nurse thing and the whatever, like all these other services that are a huge part of the value, so that when you as the customer are thinking about insurance, you're not actually comparing, you know, that price for price, you're not comparing like for like.
Yeah.
Because with First for Women, you get 400 other things, whereas with OUTsurance, it's just the bog standard insurance. And I think that's important, that frame the value of your offering so that people know why it's worth spending more with you or continuing to choose you. And then I guess the other part for me is just, you know, when times are tough, people need to feel something. They want to feel anything remotely positive. And whether that's humor or inspiration or whatever it is, you know, lean into that. They don't need to be reminded that life is hard. We know.
Yeah.
We know how much petrol costs. Believe me, we know. But brands that find a way to tap into whatever, hope, inspiration, joy, humor, love, doesn't matter. But to tap into some kind of emotion is hugely powerful.
If you're enjoying The Lead Creative, please share this episode with your network and hit follow or subscribe. Enjoy the show.
So I get the part about the emotion. The other side that I get from this is also this notion of staying true to who you are as a brand, or at least living up to whatever that brand promise is in good and sort of tough times. Mm. Something in line with that is something that we found in a recent report that we were doing, the Township CX report, where consumers in townships are telling us that they are more likely to buy from a brand that understands them rather than a brand that advertises to them more. But then again, advertising is interesting because sometimes, you know, the greatest is when you don't know you're being advertised to, right? But nonetheless, people say they're more likely to buy from brands that that understand them more. How do you prove this as a brand beyond your advertising? How do you show people that you understand them? You mentioned this a bit earlier when we started the conversation about, you know, about living up to your brand promise, showing that you are there, being present. But how do you show? How do you prove that as brand X, I understand you? How do you prove that you really got that human insight about whoever you're trying to communicate with?
Yeah, for sure. You know, it's funny when you were saying now about how consumers are more likely to connect with a brand or choose a brand that understands them. I mean, how would you know they understand you if they didn't advertise to you? Yeah. So it's kind of like
chicken and egg.
It is a little bit of a chicken and egg. But I think to your point around how does a brand do that? How do you show that you understand them? You know, I guess there's two ways. One is really being present in their world. And what's so cool about that the world that we are living in and moving more into, particularly amongst young people, is that they are, how do I put it? The kind of fragmentation that has happened means that young people can be into anything, sure. Right? There's almost no stereotypical, you know, whatever, 18-year-old black teenager from Alex, right? You can have an 18-year-old black teenager from Alex who is into rock and roll music and loves skateboarding, but also loves the Chisanyama, but also loves his mom, but also is mean to his girlfriend, but also, do you know what I mean? We're no longer, I'm not even sure we ever were, but we've been empowered to be a part of so many communities that feed us in any way, shape or form. And I think the exciting opportunity for brands is to then show up in the things that I care about, you know. So if Mungezi cares about an orphanage that he happens to volunteer at the weekend, show up, right? Show up in those spaces. If music is his thing and he's, you know, on the weekends checking out new up-and-coming DJs, I don't know, show up, you know. So I think find out what people are passionate about and make sure that you are present in those spaces in a way that's relevant. But that's very much in a advertising space almost, or experience space. The other thing is also in your products. So really thinking about, you know, how can I deliver whatever it is that I make best to Mungezi, and what does that look like? So if I use the First Foreman example, I think, you know, their first innovation was around how they communicated insurance for like your handbags and your shoes and like those kinds of things, because that's important to the audience, right? And then expanded into the nurse functionality and the guardian angel and all of that. That shows that I understand you. I understand your day-to-day life and how hard it is being a woman, and these are the things that matter to you. And similarly, if I think about, chocolate brand, they make the little balls and they've got like nuts and everything. Ferrero Rocher, right?
Like, tells you my knowledge of chocolates.
That's okay. That's why they care. We bring different things to the table. What I thought was quite cool is that they were always seen as a gifting brand, you know, so something I buy at Christmas to give to people or whatever, or someone's birthday, which means people are buying it maybe twice a year. But that also had a lot to do with price, right? That you only got it in that massive diamond-shaped thing, and it was a lot of money to spend for just a weekend. And by innovating into a much smaller format, so just the three chocolates, and hitting a price point that's affordable, they've unlocked massive growth. And I think that those are different things, right? Yeah. It's about what does my customer need and how can I innovate my products and services to meet them where they are rather than asking them to meet me where I am.
That's an interesting one. Just to switch a little bit from that, we often talk about, I think, brands being on the right side of a narrative, being on the right side of history. And this is easier said than done. And, you know, this is coming up time and time again that we always say brands should be on the right side of history. But for every community that you stand for, besides being a brand that discriminates against people for, you know, reasons that aren't sensible, for any community that you stand for, you also stand to, call it, offend or be on the other side of a different community. Mm. When do brands know which side to be on? How do you know? And how do you know that this is the right side to be on? I mean, we just spoke about faux pas that brands sometimes find themselves in the middle of. And a lot of the time it's because you are trying to stand for one community and not another. I mean, in South Africa, it was Pride. We're having this conversation, it's Pride Month. Some brands, of course, stand up for LGBTQI+ communities as they should. And for every brand that does, there's a community that speaks up against whatever it is that they're doing. How do you know as a brand which side of history to be?
I mean, I think it's about what you believe in, right? And like even now, you said, you know, discriminate against people for things that are not sensible. You know, that what's sensible to you may not be sensible to the next person, right? Yeah, I mean, you think this LGBTQI+ stuff is sensible, but there are many audiences who don't. And, you know, I think it's just about understanding what your brand has put forward and said you're about. And if your values, as an example, are around inclusivity and all of that kind of thing, then, you know, the side of history you want to be on is an obvious one. You know what I mean? So it's about the moral compass of your brand. And unfortunately, no one else can tell you that but the people who are influencing it and who are responsible for running that brand. And if we think about where the world is heading, I do think inclusivity in all of its facets is increasingly where brands will need to anchor themselves. And you will offend. Sorry, to your point, you will absolutely offend people, and you must be okay with that. You must be okay with the fact that we think this is the right position to take. And there will be those who disagree, and that's fine. But, you know, we want to be, as you said, on what we understand to be the right side of history. And if we're proven wrong at some point, then, you know, we learn and we move forward. But I do think that it has to take a stand. And I think Nike is often the example. I mean, I know the example you're thinking of now is Woolworths in the context of Pride. And, you know, Nike dealt with the exact same issue when they first did the Colin Kaepernick work around taking a stand and him taking a knee and all of that. And the initial response was really terrible, right? Their stock price plummeted and people were buying Nikes to burn them, which helped boost their sales. But in the event, that's a separate issue. I always find that really hilarious. I'm so mad at you, I'm going to buy your product and burn it. Oh, okay, well, great.
As long as you buy it.
Keep doing that. You know what I mean? Keep doing that. But within a very short time frame, the response was overwhelming, right? Not just in terms of consumers and people who were really completely bought into it, but the amount of kind of celebrity endorsement of people standing up and saying, thank God Nike's doing something. And then you see it in their business results, right? I mean, their share price doubled after a while and has stayed on a relative high thereafter. So I think, you know, when you're doing the right thing, people will recognize you for it. It's just about making sure that you're doing it because it's true to who you are, as opposed to because it's appropriate. You know, it's Pride Month, so let's quickly do something on Pride Month. I don't think people have a lot of energy for that. You know, I think it might have landed, the Colin Kaepernick thing might have landed differently if it was just a, what's that month? Black History Month, right? If it was just a Black History Month campaign and then Nike moved on, I don't think that would have landed. But because they were saying it's much bigger than that, this is something we believe that systemic racism is a problem and needs to be fixed. And I think that people then make a choice about whether you're the kind of brand for them or not.
Now, with that in mind, what tends to happen? Because there's this there's this beautiful place called Twitter. What tends to happen is that brands don't, in some instances, they know what they stand for, they know who they are, but for fear of being on the wrong side of any community, brands tend to almost want to whitewash every single thing that kind of exists there, or at least be seen to be part of it. In instances when brands do this, or in instances when marketers do this, how do you do that? How are you as a brand participating in things and not lose your essence? Because you tend to, right? If you're part of everything, how do you do both? For instance, how do you stand for communities and stand for causes and not lose your essence, your brand essence as a brand? Or is there no middle ground?
I think it's the same thing, that standing for causes and communities should be anchored in your brand essence, in terms of who you are. You know, if that's what you, if you know your brand essence, you'll know the communities and causes where you can and should participate, and you'll know what your perspective should be in those spaces. Nando's is always the example everybody uses. My understanding of how they see their role, aside from kind of humor and the spiciness or the peri-periness of their commentary, in some ways, I think they see their role in like holding a mirror up to society in some ways. Some of the topics that they take on is about saying that this is not okay, right? Look at the world we live in, and that's not okay. Yeah. And I think that I have no doubt Nando's offends people. Of course it does. But they stand their ground, and then they don't get defensive, right? They allow their fans to be the ones who defend them. And I think that's what powerful brands do, you know, and powerful people do. You stand in your truth. This is my truth. This is what I believe. This is what I think is right. And I don't think it serves brands to get into, like, you know, boxing matches on platforms like that. I think it is about using your essence to stand on the side of things that you think is relevant. And if you aren't going to have a clear point of view to articulate on something, then don't talk about it. You don't have to. It's fine. You can be a vanilla brand and it's fine. And you can be for everyone and be safe and stand in the background. It's fine. Because I think it's actually worse to wade into a conversation without a clear point of view.
In such a noisy marketplace that's becoming noisier by the day, how do brands still win the hearts and minds of people? You mentioned that, you know, sometimes it takes time, sometimes the brands that you know started off in, or at least started growing or became prominent in the 80s, are now seen as, call it, heritage brands of some sort. And they haven't been, I mean, there are much older brands like than those, and yet because of the noise, the ones that either play with the noise or are there tend to be seen, and ones that don't tend to not be seen. I mean, there are very popular, for instance, pencil brands that we haven't heard of, but it's the pencil that you buy every time, and they hardly ever advertise. Yeah. And how do you stand out in such a noisy marketplace? Or, you know, or is that a thing of, I suppose, brands of the past, when there was less noise and there was advertising was prominent in people's eyes and we weren't seeing 1,000 ads or whatever, you know?
So I think there's two parts to your question, or two answers rather. In terms of brands that don't advertise and still seem to get a lot of, and maybe advertising is limiting. Let me say brands that choose not to communicate or engage with their audiences, and are still chosen. You cited pencil brands. I think it's Yeah, you see now people always laugh at me when I start referencing books, but I read a lot, this is who I am. So Daniel Kahneman, who wrote Thinking Fast and Slow, talks about the two modes of decision-making, right? That the system one, which is quite intuitive and emotive, and it's about associations that have been built up in your mind over a long time. And so you're not actually thinking about it, right? You're just kind of reacting intuitively and often quite emotionally. And the other one, which is the much more rational, considered, you evaluated all the options, it's much slower, much more methodical. And what he talks about in his book is that 95% of decisions are made in system one. 95%, right? So your pencil choice is not a choice you're making today. It's a choice you made, I don't know how old you are, let's say 15 years ago, and you're just continuing to make that choice because nobody has bothered to build other associations in your mind, right? Yeah. Nobody else has bothered. And I think that same pencil brand, so let's say Staedtler, if there were other pencil brands who were out there shouting and building associations, then they would have to, right? They would have to up their game and do something. But at the moment, you know, when nobody is really doing anything, you just default to the ones where you have the strongest associations and some kind of emotional connection, because your poor brain is not interested in having to think deeply about my choice of pencil. I've got bigger things to think about than my choice of pencil. And I think that that's quite an important point. But your thing around how do you stand out? You know, I think brands that stand out are brands that have something to say that's relevant to the audience and that matters, and that will connect with me. I mean, I think PPS Insurance, which is the insurance bank for professionals, relatively small brand with actually quite a tiny audience, because you have to have qualified from university and be a professional, so doctors, lawyers, accountants, etc. Like, that's kind of who they talk to. So very, very small audience, and they don't communicate as much as other insurance brands, so not like an OUTsurance or First for Women. But they've done this work recently called Finding the Forgotten Graduate, and a friend shared it with me. I must have looked at that thing 8 times since I got it last week. It is beautiful and profound and speaks to me and is relevant. And it's just, you know, brands who, again, have something to say and understand what's relevant to their audiences. That's how you stand out. Not just by spending the most money, although, I mean, yeah, spending a lot of money will get you stand out. But, you know, it really is about, do you actually have something to say? And critically, something to say that I care about.
Yeah.
If you're enjoying The Lead Creative, please share this episode with your network and hit follow or subscribe. Enjoy the show.
There's something on this building new associations, building associations versus ones decisions that you've already made, because there's another brand or another player that has built those associations. There's a space right now, especially in South Africa, where there's a lot of advertising. There seems to be a lot of competition, and this is in insurance, where there's a lot of, especially within the out of home space, sort of a lot of out of home communications where challenger brands are doing a lot to build these kinds of associations, and they're doing it so much that I'm starting to see more established, call it legacy brands, or brands that have become sort of heritage brands, starting to almost fall into this space of how these challenger brands are communicating. Yeah. How do you not waver as a brand and still stand your ground? Because I feel like this is so important in this space where, you know, there are insurance brands that have always communicated a particular way, communicated being the second option, right? We are not option A, we're option B, you know, and we are for the B team, whatever. You know, there are brands that have always been that. And now there are other options that are saying, hey, we're not that. We are, you know, we're not this. We are a fruit. We're not, you know, this, we're that. Like, how do you stand your ground when someone is so committed to building these new associations in our minds as customers?
Yeah, you see, the answer is a very simple one, but it's not necessarily easy. you've got to stay true to who you are. Like, it's just, it never works when you try and mimic what somebody else is doing, because you will never do it as well as they do. And you will look a little bit ridiculous, right? Because you're trying to be someone who you're not. And it's the same as seeing, you know, an older person who, you know, I don't know, has dressed like an accountant their whole life, you know, suddenly discover skinny jeans and being like, wait a minute, this is the thing. Like, it's a little bit ridiculous. That's not who you are. And I think that that's something that, you know, I understand the pressure, right? Because you see competitors and they are growing and they are being talked about. It's not just insurance. The telco industry is also very guilty of this, of kind of seeing what competitor A is doing and be like, oh, also us. Let's do something. But I really do think that that's the role of the brand team, the CMO and the agency that they work with, to kind of be like, no, guys, but that's fine. They can own that more irreverent, playful space. You know, we are for these kinds of people, right? This is who we are for. And this is why the, whatever, 10 million people who've chosen us have chosen us. So do we abandon them and kind of chase this new hot, sexy thing? Or do we stay true to who we are, always making sure that we are still showing up in a way that matters to those people? Because what mattered 20 years ago is probably different, because people change and grow. But never lose sight of why people would have chosen you in the first place, because then you lose them. It's as simple as that.
We're seeing a lot happening in the space of AI at the moment, a lot of conversation. I mean, AI, of course, AI has been around in very many forms, in very many ways. But as some people would say, these platforms have given us more toys to play with within the AI space. How can brand strategy and marketing tap into the advancements that we are seeing in AI? Is it possible? Are there possibilities? Are there things that you've seen, that you've experienced or explored in recent times?
Absolutely. You know, I agree with you completely that these are more tools that help us to hopefully think more broadly and tap into things that we may not have considered on our own. And hopefully also expedite some of the research that we do, you know, in developing our thinking. So I do see it as a really powerful tool to help us. And the way that we use it is that often when it's almost in a way to put it like at the beginning and at the end of the process, right? For lack of a better term, right? So at the beginning, you know, as you're starting to explore different areas and research different things, you know, I would use it. And at the moment, only ChatGPT. I know there's others, but, I'm not an early adopter. I'm a, what do you call it? A laggard. There you go. I'm at the back, and I'll move with others. So on ChatGPT, you know, looking at, as a question, you know, so if we're doing, you know, we were doing a project for an FMCG brand in East Africa at the moment. And so understanding the landscape in East Africa is incredibly important, right? To understand how to position these brands for relevance. And so often it is about using it to say kind of, you know, what are the emerging trends in Kenya? What are people worried about in Rwanda? Where are the consistencies, etc.? And using that as just a jumping off point to make sure that there are things that you are researching that you may not have thought of before. And then again, just to check at the end to make sure, have we explored everything? You know, is there something that I haven't thought about? Is there some, you know, a little nugget that maybe I might have missed? And I think the reason I say that is because also we know, like anything else that's new in technology, it's very unreliable, yes. Right? There's no guarantee that the information it's giving you is factually correct. And so it is important that it's just a jumping off point to make sure that you are considering lots of things, but then you still go and do the research. You know, you still go and find out. You still go and talk to actual consumers to be like, this is what we think about Ugandan consumers. Is that the case? Yes. Is it not? Yeah. You know, it's hugely important that you don't kind of ignore that process because you have technology. So I think people who don't just see it as that, as a tool to enable us to do our work more efficiently, more robustly, are making a mistake.
Yeah, because I mean, like you're saying, in some instances, it helps with the quality of questions that you can ask to get to a human insight or get to it quicker or better. In closing, Rufilwe, you've said a lot about brands showing up about advertising. And a lot of it has to do with knowing your essence, living up to it, putting in the time to communicate, standing your ground when you know what that essence is, and kind of being present and showing that you are present even in tough times. Are there any other thoughts on how brands can either show up, improve how they show up, or show up better and more with sort of, you know, more qualitatively, as it were, in these hard and tough times?
No, I mean, I think there definitely is. And the one that you and I have spoken about a little bit, Mwangezi, is the CSI/CSR work that most companies do. I think there is such a huge opportunity to turn the work that your organization does in the CSI space into a really powerful demonstration of what your brand is about. I think sometimes there is a temptation for the CSI team to kind of operate independently and to kind of just choose projects that they're passionate about and use the money for that, because they know the money is guaranteed, right? Because it's got to be a percentage of turnover. And I'm not saying that those initiatives are wrong at all. I mean, it's there's so much need in South Africa. Of course, there's going to be many things that tug at the heartstrings. Yeah. But, you know, if your promise as a brand, and I'll just go back to using Apple because we were talking about it, is about creating tools for creative minds, what does that mean in a CSI space, right? So, you know, are you empowering young entrepreneurs across the continent to develop their own tools? You know, are you giving some of your tools to whatever, upskills, like different industries? Just really, you know, instead of just giving money to a school feeding program, as an example, really think about how you can leverage those millions of rand sometimes to create impact that continues to reinforce what your brand is about. And I think that that's really important. I think it's worth the hard conversations that need to happen about, are we spending our money appropriately, and are we creating meaningful impact that speaks to what our brand promises? And it becomes an incredibly powerful thing for you to then communicate when times are tough, because people also communicate you talking about the value you add to communities who aren't giving you anything, right? You know, because they know how hard times are. And so a brand that can stand up and say, whatever, you know, we've empowered 300,000 entrepreneurs across the continent, and they now are self-sustaining businesses that employ two people, whatever it may be, that's incredibly powerful and a demonstration of your commitment to create tools for creative minds. And so I think that that's what you've got to try and lean into, right, is how do we leverage what we do in the CSI space to deliver impact, but impact that is a demonstration of our brand promise.
Awesome. That's, I wouldn't have said it better. And that's a really great insight. Thank you so much for making the time once again. It was a really great conversation.
Thank you so much, Mwangezi. Really appreciate you inviting me on to talk. And thank you to your listeners as well.
Thank you for listening to The Lead Creative. Did you get one insight that's worth sharing from this episode? Please share it with your network or your friends. Pop me some of your ideas and innovative finds on Twitter on @Mwangezi. This podcast is available on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple, Google, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find me on Mwangezi.com.